Thanks for tuning in today. I'm Dr. Nick, the Incrementalist. Join me as I seek out the small incremental changes being applied in other industries that we can learn from and that can be applied in healthcare. Can these changes bring immediate value, but also add up to the big improvements and revolution we need in healthcare? Come along with me to explore the possibilities. My innovative guests from around the globe have used small incremental improvements to achieve their moonshot. And today, I'm delighted to be joined by Dan Sidon. He is the Chief Technology Officer for NextGate. Dan, thanks for joining me.
Thank you, Dr. Nick. I appreciate the opportunity to talk about this topic.
So before we kick off talking about national patient identifiers, and to be clear, that always feels like a third rail topic in this country and maybe in other countries. Tell us a little bit about yourself. Who are you? How did you get to where you are? And maybe just a little bit about NextGate.
So I like to think of myself as a failed mechanical engineer. I graduated with a mechanical engineering degree about 25 years ago, and it was just at the worst timing in the Detroit auto industry was just totally falling apart. Wow. So I struggled really to find employment as a mechanical engineer. And after working for a company that was basically doing engine mounts, then I decided that's not for me. So at the time, that was a real booming period, you know, the internet boom, the late 90s, and I kind of stumbled into the development of software. And I stumbled into an organization that worked on the integration of healthcare systems. So they were really a leading supplier of what are called integration engines that connect two different systems that otherwise would not be able to be connected. And in all of that kind of work, then we started to realize that identity was really important when exchanging information between two different systems. Yeah, so it's not just the message format or how do you deliver it, but it's who the heck are we talking about? And that's where I really began to dive into that area of identity management. I formed NextGate with two partners. So there's three of us all together that are the co-founders of NextGate, really because we're all passionate about this topic. We felt that really this is a space in and of itself. It's not just a part of interoperability or a part of integration, but it's a core element that needs to be managed. And that's how we started NextGate and grew it over the last 15 years to where it is today.
Fantastic. So I always love people that end up in these areas through passion. I think that's, you know, there was a thread recently trending that talked about, you know, the importance of, you know, finding a pathway in careers. And I often quote this, you know, love what you do and you'll never work another day in your life. And that's all about the passion. And you found that with this sort of identity management. I get the sense you've maybe come up against a brick wall in the healthcare system where, we could identify an engine, for example. There's a stamped number on it, but we don't have that in healthcare. Tell us a little bit about your sort of understanding of where we are with the identifier in healthcare today.
Yeah, so I mean, what we in the industry have struggled with over the last 20 years is that we have only a very kind of hazy notion of who the individual is when they're being provided care. And that hazy notion of identity is centered around things like their name, their address, their phone number, different demographic attributes that are really kind of poorly managed, right? You can enter, you know, your name, Nicholas, Nick, any number of ways. You know, it's also something that changes over time. So your address, you know, where you are today may not be where your address is 5 years from now or where you were 5 years ago. So to base identity on that is very challenging. And you're absolutely right. There's a certain kind of fundamental operational efficiency that you can get with that kind of a system. So just like a combustion engine, it can only get, I don't know, 30-35%, you know, based on thermodynamics. Then it's kind of the same case with patient identity, that at some point, your ability to deal with all that kind of messiness and volatile data, you can only do so well. And that is the brick wall. I mean, we continue to kind of, you know, optimize on the edges of that problem. And I guess, you know, part of your show is incrementalist. So we do kind of incrementally improve upon it. And there is improvements that can be made, but there is also a certain limit to how far that can go.
Understanding the healthcare system here and, you know, different places in around the world have different methods, but I think everybody struggles with this identifier problem. I don't think it's unique to us.
Yeah.
Although we have a little bit of a unique position that dates back to some legislation that essentially precluded any sort of use or even almost investigation of a patient identifier. Is that the case? What's your understanding of the circumstance here in the US?
Yeah, so I mean, when I started in this space was actually just when HIPAA came into being, and part of HIPAA was also to provide a patient identification, a national patient identifier. I believe, and I'm not the best person on this topic about the details of legislation and laws and all of that, but my understanding is that a couple of years following into that, there was an amendment made to ban the usage of funds, federal funding, to investigate, I think they use the word promulgate, a national patient identification. So that's what put the brakes on it. It was largely driven, from my understanding, based on the constituents having concerns around privacy and the idea that single identifier, you know, could potentially be used to tie together all of the different points of care that you've had and maybe give a little bit too much insight into your medical history, which could, of course, then be used for things like, insurance or your employment ability and things like that. So I think that's what put the brakes on it. You do see other countries such as England, you know, that at exactly that time, I believe in the mid 90s is when they rolled out their NHS number. That's a great case study for how successful or not successful is, you know, that sort of method for trying to manage patient identity. But it's interesting to note that at exactly the point that the U.S. put the brakes on it, that's exactly where England really began to take off with the use of a national ID.
So you're right. And, I've had a number of guests on this show and, you know, huge advocate of privacy. But ultimately, when you think about that in the context of healthcare, certainly as things have played out since then, the fact that we didn't have normally, I mean, I think the social security number is used as such, much to certainly my personal irritation, and I know other people, but healthcare has the biggest target on its back. It's the richest reaping grounds for identity theft because of the data that it contains. And that's not proven to be very helpful in the context of protecting security. So perhaps it's a time for change, do you think?
Yeah, I mean, I think that the stopgap measures that have been put into place over these last 20 years, I would argue, have probably made privacy worse in a sense, right? Because it, as opposed to using an identifier or a series of identifiers for different, instances of care, what you end up having is the usage of your demographics and, you know, companies like us, quite frankly, that are trying to do the best that they can. And we have no nefarious purpose in our life. We don't sell data. We don't centralize the data. We're just providing a service to our customers so that they can function with the services that they're trying to provide across a number of systems. So I think that the fact that so much identity now is based on things like your name and your date of birth and other factors, I think that's actually worse for privacy because now, since so many systems are kind of attuned to using that, they will make decisions and tie your data based on that. And if that ever gets compromised, it's a lot harder to change your name or to change your date of birth or change things that really you cannot change, right? As opposed to, I have a compromised ID. I would like to retire that ID. And have a new one issued, or I would like to have multiple IDs issued based on whether I'm, you know, being seen by a mental health specialist or somebody else where I really would like to hide some aspect of my care. I want to kind of keep it within a smaller circle of people. So I think the time has definitely come to revisit this topic. I think that and part of what we're seeing is also, for example, the House of Representatives, they recently overturned that ban. It still has to be taken over to the Senate, and then finally, you know, the amendment passed. But it's questionable as to whether that's going to happen. But I think there is an understanding that the time has come to revisit this, because what we're doing today is just absolute madness, I would say.
Yeah, it's interesting, I think, you know, you bring up a great point around sort of, you know, more granular control around those IDs versus, hey, I've identified you, I've got all of your information potentially, right, or at least all of the information that I have legitimate access to. As you say that, it reminds me a lot of, you know, many of the word streams I hear around blockchain and the capacity to control and that distributed ledger. Do you think that technology lends itself to this? Is there some concept around that that could potentially offer us some opportunity or solutions here?
Yeah, I mean, I do. I think there's been a lot of noise and confusion also about blockchain, a lot of people not really understanding what it's for. It's not some sort of a massive database where you're going to start putting, you know, pieces of information, clinical information, or really your identity. What ends up being a valid use case for blockchain is proofs of your identity, so that other people can independently verify that the information that you're providing has been certified by some third party. So I think that, you know, what we're beginning to see in the industry, and we're certainly very excited about it at NextGate, is the notion that you get to know who your patient is. You know, a lot of industries have the whole notion of know your customer, KYC, which has been relatively foreign within healthcare, right? I mean, it's like you show up, they give you the same stupid piece of paper that's, you know, that they've been giving you for 20 years that says, you know, please enter your name, please enter your address. Yeah, you know, do you have any known medications and allergies and whatever? You know, that is just absolutely absurd. And I think people have come to have seen in other industries, you know, that operate far more efficiently, you know, whether it's travel or financial or whatnot, and they're like, why are we still doing this? So I mean, I think that knowing your patient, so KYP, I guess, is certainly the future of identity management. You know, we are positioning ourselves as a vendor that is also capable, an EMPI vendor that's also capable of accepting that kind of digital identity, because we know that's coming. It's not going to be something that completely solves the identification problem, but it will get us a hell of a lot closer there, because then you are basically coming with your own credentials. And those credentials, and this goes back to your question about blockchain, what makes those credentials valid would be the usage of blockchain. So that's, at least that's the way that we're seeing it right now.
So for those of you just joining, I'm Dr. Nick, the Incrementalist, and today I'm talking to Dan Sidon. He is the Chief Technology Officer for NextGate. We're talking about national patient identifiers and the fact that we have none, although, you know, people tend to use the social security. And you know, the point you were just making, I mean, I've heard this, one of my previous guests who talks about supermarket insights and the fact that, you know, we give up all of this information to the supermarket. We have this one card that identifies us. They know more about your health. And in fact,
That's
proposition was that they could predict your HbA1c based on your supermarket data. Beyond your medical data, it just, you know, so this whole privacy thing just, it just rings untrue for me. But let's pause reality for a second, if you would, and imagine a world where people can actually have a civilized discussion, reach some agreement, and the national patient identifier for healthcare comes to fruition. You mentioned this. It's not a magic bullet, though, is it?
No, and I think we've seen that in countries that have implemented a national patient ID, the challenges that they have. So, I mean, in my experience, I have basically worked both in England and in Scotland that have had programs like this. In Scotland, which is a far, you know, smaller country, it is actually quite effective. They've had their CHI number, their community health ID, for a very long time, and they manage it very closely. So your ID actually is based on certain elements of your demographics. You know, so if they get that wrong, they end up having to issue a new ID. For example, if they get your date of birth wrong, they manage it very tightly. And we have seen that has been relatively successful. But if you just go across the border and you look in England, I mean, it's a bit of a mess, you know, with their NHS number. I mean, we have had to install our EMPI in over a dozen trusts. And the reason for that is basically the quality of the NHS number is insufficient. There are duplications. There are times when the NHS number really represents a husband and a wife, you know, and they're just kind of somehow using the same number. You know, there's a segment of systems, a large segment of systems that don't even store the NHS number. Especially around social services types of systems. So that's how we ended up, you know, showing up in countries that supposedly had solved the problem with a national patient ID. So having said that, you know, I would say that quality of records that we have seen in our work in England is certainly far better than the United States. I mean, the social security number, as you say, is absolutely horrible. mechanism by which to try to identify an individual. It is far overused in too many different contexts. It has really nothing to do with health. It has no capability of ensuring that the number is even entered correctly. So at least the NHS number has a checksum at the end of it. You know, so there's a lot of improvements that the NHS number did provide. And that's why, you know, if you look at some of our comments, you know, from the ONC and other, you know, to other kinds of organizations that have asked us for our comments on a national patient ID, we've been supporters of it. I mean, absolutely. Any additional piece of information that we can use to do our job better, then, you know, we're all for it. It will certainly incrementally help. But yeah, our experience is that this is not, this will not be the end solution, and probably something more around decentralized identity and what you were talking about earlier with blockchain. Eventually, that those kinds of technologies are going to do a better job of it.
So it's interesting you bring up the NHS number. I have one. Actually, I have two.
Well, there you go.
But that's actually a historical thing. So the NHS number that I actually know off by heart was relatively short and made up of letters followed by numbers in my instance. It changed to something new. And it never seemed long enough to cover the whole population. I was always, you know, somewhat perturbed by that as I thought about it mathematically. But it never fulfilled the purpose. It was very clear to me at the time. And, you know, I think it has good intentions,
yeah,
but struggles. And I think what's important is you sort of described this. It's that additional matching. It sort of helps. It gets you to a point of, you know, a reasonable level of identity, but then you add in the additional layers. And, you know, I spent time working in the Middle East, and what's interesting there is a birthday is not a significant in some countries and, you know, for people. So birthdays get, you know, recorded as the most convenient day. Sometimes the day that they are visiting, sometimes the 1st of January, and, you know, their best guess at a year. So we miss all of those pieces of data. How do you approach this from a corporate standpoint to bring us to a real identity with certainty?
Right. Yeah. I mean, I think that, you know, what you're describing are some of the challenges around using a national patient identifier. I mean, we've seen specifically in England, it tended to be immigrant populations that were the most poorly identified, and probably has something to do with some of the things you've said. You know, I mean, when you ask a person for their date of birth or whatever, they may not actually know it, or they may have different numbers that they give you, and you wonder yourself, how is that even possible? But even names, for example, we saw massive cases of transpositions of names because they didn't know, is that the first name, is that the last name? Sometimes the last name is the name of the town where they grew up in, you know. So, you know, and you know, also coming back to the notion that in order to use an NHS number, you know, for you know, to provide care, you have to know what your NHS number is in the first place. So are you carrying it as a card? You know, do you have it scribbled down somewhere in your wallet? I mean, how do you even find the person, you know, if they're coming to you without the NHS number? So those are, you know, some of the challenges, you know, that we see. And I think what has really changed in the last, you know, 10 years or so is just how ubiquitous mobile devices are and wearable devices now are. I mean, I've avoided the whole, you know, the whole Apple Watch thing. Still, I'm still waiting another 5 years, you know, just to before. I'm not an early adopter of any sort. I have always, you know, I had a flip phone well after people started getting the iPhones and all of that. Terrible, I know. But
this
you know,
the CEO of the company, right?
I know, and I get jokes about that, by the way. But I just, you know, I like to use technology when I feel like it's really gotten to a maturity where it's useful as opposed to just kind of an experimental thing. I think definitely, you know, if you look at mobile phones and wearables, I mean, just so many people are using it, right? I mean, kids all the way from 11 years old up until, you know, elderly, 85, 90 years old, you're using these things. And I think what makes that important for identity is that in a sense, you can help to identify a person just using those kinds of devices, because those devices have some built-in authentication associated with them. I mean, it's not bulletproof, but you know, the phone that I have here now, if it's based on Face ID, so it has to be the case that I'm at least the one that's unlocking it. Most of them have fingerprint. They all have something, you know, some technology. And if you couple that with some sort of mechanism to carry your digital credentials, then you have the components required to identify you without you having to open up your wallet and say, oh, my NHS number is blah. So, I mean, I hope, and I know I've seen the dialogues regarding the national patient ID. It may not be just a number that you know, the whole new, what is it, the Medicare beneficiary ID, which is literally just a number. It may be something more around digital credentials. It may be something like that. My understanding is that all folks are asking for is just start the dialogue, you know, allow the government to invest some money to research an appropriate strategy around national patient identification. And it's not necessarily that they're going to come up with a 20 plus year old system like the NHS did, you know, when they did this in the mid 90s.
Yeah, and I think you raise an important point. So for anybody that's in legislative power, you know, important person to talk to, I would advocate, you know, come talk to Dan and your organization. I'm serious. I mean, I think you have insights on this because you mentioned some specific things that are just obvious to me, but maybe not in the instance like the checksum at the end so that we've got some validation, all of those things. And, you know, this concept that, you know, privacy is the sort of central tenet. If you think you have any privacy, just give me your browsing history and I'll show you why you don't. And by the way, you've already given it away. So
I would agree with you there that anyone who thinks they really have any level of privacy these days, it really doesn't. But, you know, I would. At the same time, I would say it doesn't give us license to come up with schemes or architectures or whatever that just make the problem, you know, worse. And so I think some of the kind of concepts that have been slowly being introduced, and again, as you mentioned around blockchain, I think those would allow an environment by which no single entity is kind of the keeper of your identity. I think that eventually, I hope that will be a reality, because so long as a single issuing authority is kind of at the center point, then you run the risk that, as you say, you know, that we will get into this kind of surveillance state mode, you know, and I think there's very valid reasons why people are concerned about that, even though, like you say, it's not much we can do about it. Yeah.
Not to diminish it. And I take a track of obfuscation, and that's easy with my name because there's like 1,000 variations, but, you know, data is very good at assembling. In the final minute, I'm just curious, you talked about the mobile device. That's an identifier. Yeah. I know for a fact that there are stores and technology that will allow them to identify you just by walking in based on your device, tile the, you know, and some of that's nefarious to me, and I'm not advocating that. But I think what you're suggesting is some concept around that with permission based.
With permission, absolutely. Yeah.
Would allow for this. So where do we go in the next year or so?
Yeah, I mean, I think we need to go down that track of putting the patient in charge of their own identity and allowing them to decide how much information do they disclose at any given point of care in any setting. I think that as an industry, all of the discussions, you know, around, for example, a new national patient identification scheme has to have that, you know, as a central component, because otherwise this prohibition is going to continue. There are very loud advocates on the privacy side that, you know, that will shoot it down. And I think that, you know, while it has not done us good from the perspective of being able to share information, and we have these clip charts and we have to keep putting our names and whatever, you know, it has been certainly an important voice. And so I think that our future in the identification area will be, you know, to come up with a scheme that allows the patient to be in control, and at the same time to do it in a way that prevents fraud by having some third parties be able to verify that identity and to attest to it, so that it's it's verifiable information.
Fantastic. So I think the incremental step that I hear clearly here is that we need to move towards this national patient identifier for more privacy as a result of, you know, the circumstance we find ourselves in. unfortunately, as usual, we've run out of time. So it just remains for me to thank you, Dan, for joining me on the show. Fascinating conversation. I think exciting progress, and delighted that you and your organization are sort of approaching this and attacking this problem for us.
Yeah, thank you, Dr. Nick. I appreciate the opportunity, and it was a great dialogue.
Thanks for joining me today. Do you have any better ideas, or have you found a small incremental change that's brought about a big improvement in your world? Let's continue the conversation on our hashtag, The Incrementalist, or share with me at DrNick1 on Twitter. You can find more information about the show on our program page at healthcarenowradio.com. And tune in next time to hear my discussions with leaders and innovators from around the globe who've revolutionized their space by using small incremental improvements to achieve their moonshot. I'm Dr. Nick, The Incrementalist, and I'm starting a revolution through evolution.